From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in August of 2017 on a flight to China when a Google engineer wrote an internal memo about the company's policy on diversity. James Damore made a number of points, but perhaps most controversial was his contention that Google wants to blur the differences between men and women. Damore wrote that a tech company can't expect to hire equal numbers of men and women because men naturally gravitate toward the field more than women do. Damore claimed that women tend more toward high anxiety and neuroticism than men do, and that might have something to do with the numbers as well. Google fired Damore, sparking a national debate about sexism, equality, ideological expression, and that debate has only picked up steam in recent months. One of the hottest pieces on the subject came from author Andrew Sullivan. In New York Magazine, Sullivan wrote that there are natural differences between men and women, and modern feminists on the political left want to obscure those differences. Here he is writing, quote, "Men can and should be restrained, tamed, kept under control, but nature will not be eradicated. And when left feminism denies nature's power, ignores testosterone, and sees all this behavior as a function entirely of structural patriarchal oppression, it is going to overreach, it is going to misunderstand, and it is going to alienate a lot of people. If most men are told that what they are deep down is, in fact, problematic, if not toxic, they are going to get defensive, and with good reason," end quote. So, are critics missing the point? Are we talking past one another? Are we talking about the same things? Is there any common ground to be found here? My guests are going to discuss that and more this hour. Welcome back to Dr. Barbara Lee Savoy, the Director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at the College at Brockport. Dr. Lee Savoy, nice to have you back here.
Thanks so much, Evan. I'm really happy to be here.
And Lauren Hall is an Associate Professor of Political Science at RIT, among other things, teaching a class on women in politics. Lauren, welcome back to the program to you.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Evan.
I want to start by saying, you know, very, very sincerely to the audience that I certainly understand that as we go through this throughout this hour, when we discuss differences, quote, between men and women, or we use terms just like men and women, I will probably misstep at times. And I understand that there's something a little bit exclusionary, especially for listeners who are trans or non-binary. I don't intend that to be the case. And I'd like to apologize in advance. We're going to do our best to make sure we keep everyone in mind in this conversation. But I also do want to keep it pretty well focused to a lot of the writing that's been out there on the subject. And I've chosen Andrew Sullivan's essay to work through various ideas. I could have chosen Barry Weiss of the New York Times, Christina Hoff Sommers, the American Enterprise Institute, Caitlin Flanagan at the Atlantic. They've all expressed similar ideas and aired similar complaints with modern feminism. And in every instance, I've heard feminists contend that they are just missing or distorting the points. So let me read again from Andrew Sullivan, and then we'll get our guest's first response here. He describes his experience as someone who is HIV positive, and his testosterone levels had diminished, so he went on hormone replacement therapy. Writing in New York Magazine, he said the following, quote, "I came rather abruptly face to face with what being a man means. It was a fascinating experience to witness maleness literally being injected into me. You get a real sense of what being a man is from an experience like that, as the rush of energy, strength, clarity, ambition, drive, impatience, and above all, horniness overcame me every 2 weeks in the wake of my shot. The visceral experience opened my eyes to the sheer and immense natural difference between being a man and being a woman, and helped me understand better how nature is far more in control of us than we ever want to believe. But this natural reality, reflected in chromosomes and hormones that no scientist disputes, is rarely discussed. It's almost become taboo. You can spend a lifetime in gender studies and the subject will never come up. All differences between the sexes, we are now informed, are a function of the age-old oppression of women by men, of the patriarchy that enforces this subjugation, and of the power structures that mandate misogyny. All differences between the genders, we are told, are a function not of nature, but of sexism." End quote. Strong words, Dr. Lee Savoy. So
yeah.
Let's start with your initial takes on that.
So it's a lot to unpack. I want to start off by saying that I don't think feminists or feminist scholars at this moment in time are really arguing a 100% social constructionist point of view. So I think in some ways, he's really often trying to push us into that corner. So that's point number one. I think the second point I'd like to make is that if we are to really look at this in its complexity, there's so many variations among individuals so that we can't really explain this as true for one group or another. So something that's true for men and something that's true for women has multiple variations across individual difference. But if we look at this bio argument, so he's really arguing that, you know, he has testosterone running through his blood, and that's going to make me strong and horny, and that's a, you know, a fact. And so I think the point of contention there for me is that not to argue whether or not biology is operating, because I think biology operates to make many of us different, but I think it's the way that we value that. So society has valued strength over weakness, and we put that on male bodies in ways that having more muscle becomes something that's really desired, right? And then we tend to look at those who have the weaker muscle as something that's less valuable. And I think that's where the difference becomes something that's gendered, right? And something that becomes a struggle. I like to use Julia Serrano. She's a natural scientist and a gender scholar. And what's really unique about her contribution to this discussion is that she really argues that as we understand sex and gender differences, we need to look at both biology and social constructionists and ways these two operate together, and that it's flawed to look at one without the other. So in many ways, it's a really good argument against Andrew Solomon to say that we're not feminists who are just pushing a total social constructionist point of view. And the cool thing about Serrano's work is, I was saying to Lauren when I stepped in, that she is a trans woman. And she sort of, you know, starts off by arguing, well, I know what it's like to be a man. And then I transitioned into a place that aligned my brain with my body. And now, you know, I'm very comfortably a woman, and get what it was like to take estrogen and see my muscles change. But she also argues as a natural scientist, and she was a natural scientist before she was, she's a biologist, I believe, before she was a gender scholar, that, you know, we must really look at ways we understand how biology, if we are to you know, bring that into the equation, translates into ways that we see bodies operate and what we value about that. So it's not so much about whether or not I have muscle, or you have muscle, or Lauren has muscle, but what it means to have that muscle in, you know, a space where patriarchy is dominant. If he argues that we're saying, well, patriarchy rules, I would argue that patriarchy only rules because of ways that we've divided the world and the way the world has allowed patriarchy to kind of rise up and have power. So that's really about a materialist division of public and private, sort of goes into a whole nother terrain. So I guess, you know, I would say in your answer, there's a lot to unpack, and there's a lot I would argue with. And I also think that anytime we offer any kind of extreme explanation, it's about biology, it's about social constructionism, we're really discursively removing the complexity of the question.
Okay. And so before I turn to Lauren, I also want to articulate to listeners why I think this is an important discussion to have now, not just because this question is being kicked around in a lot of different places, but because it relates to so much. If we want to talk about quote-unquote toxic masculinity, if we want to talk about the culture that leads to certain actions or expectations or behaviors, for any parent who's ever felt like, do I have to do a blue or a pink cake? does my son have to play with trucks? I've got friends who have a son who loves to wear pink and has been ridiculed. So all of this sort of interweaves, and I think what I'm hearing from Dr. Lisa Voy is this. You know, I can respect Andrew Solomon as a writer, and I've read his work for years. I think he gets a little oversimplified to kind of make the case, or at least seems to make the case, that feminism entirely removes biology. But also, I think we can agree that in the biology versus sort of nurture and social construction equation, it's somewhere on that scale. Most of our behaviors and what we're going to talk about are somewhere on that scale, and that for too long, it's been pushed onto biology. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I sort of agree with that. In some ways, the argument that I want to throw out there is that you mentioned toxic masculinity. And so I think just because you have strength or power doesn't make you a rapist. And just because you are, you know, in a male body doesn't make you, you know, toxic. And I think that's the point, you know, that we have to distill out. In some ways, the toxic masculinity is about pushing power and dominance into the equation. That's really a different thing from being masculine and a different thing from being feminine. And so, yeah, I guess, Evan, I sort of agree with you. And I think we could really pull that apart a lot more in terms of how do we get to this point that we have toxic masculinity and where did the toxicity come from?
And the reason I wanted to clarify that is because it sounds to me like Dr. Lisa Voigt thinks that there's a lot of straw man attacks going out there when we talk about feminism. For example, as you talk about, you know, masculinity and, you know, male bashing, Christina Hoff Summers of the American Enterprise Institute says modern feminism is too committed to attacking men. In an interview, she said, quote, "It's the male bashing. Young women are not naturally antagonistic toward men. In fact, they are quite fond of men. So that kind of antagonism is not going to work, thinking of men as proto-batterers, proto-rapists, and so on. And that is the message in many women's studies classes. Fortunately, many young women aren't buying it," end quote.
Not the message in my women and gender studies class. We do not male bash. We are not anti-male. Feminism is about supporting all people and equality for all people. So this notion that we're bashing the man, I always say to my students in my classes, it is not about the man. We love the man. It is about a system that has privileged men. And if we look at that in a broader picture, we're really able to see that it's about systems of equality that push out and give capital to certain groups and certain categories of identity. So it's wrong to really think about feminism as a space that's anti-male or male bashing. It might have been at one moment in time. You could think about, I could go back to Mary Daly, who was a feminist in, you know, the 1960s, and she taught at Boston College, and she actually wouldn't let men inside her classroom. I believe she was removed from her post because she wouldn't let men inside her classroom. I think there was a moment in feminism that there was this radical slant to say, like, men silence women. But we're not in that moment anymore. We are in a much broader space where we're looking at ways that we understand differences, and that is across multiple identities and multiple bodies, and there's nothing about being feminist that is anti-male.
Okay. Professor Hall, let's start with your take on Andrew Sullivan's essay.
Yeah, so on sort of first read, it seems fairly commonsensical, although I think Barbara and I are going to come down on sort of similar places when you actually look at the evidence. And I think a couple things sort of come out of this. I think he's absolutely right that modern feminism has, for whatever reason, a marketing problem. And I'm not sure if that is coming from the way in which it is sort of that people are creating a straw man out of it, or if there's a way in which it's being brought into public discussions that is sort of problematic. And I think part of what Barbara just said helps to explain this a little bit is that there was this sort of piece, and particularly sort of at the peak of the third wave of feminism in the 70s and 80s, where you see this kind of radical moment where I think you did see a lot of anger toward men and toward masculinity. And it's possible that people are still reacting to that as though it is, in fact, feminism. And so what I mean by feminism having a marketing problem is that when I teach my women in politics class, I ask all of my students every single time how many of them consider themselves a feminist, and none of them do.
None?
There's usually one, maybe one. and that, to me, is really telling. So there's something about modern feminism that it has been sort of tarred with such a sort of simplistic brush. I think it's been, you know, maybe affiliated so strongly with the sort of radicalism of the third wave that now that the kind of conversations that actually happen in gender studies programs, which are much more, I think, nuanced and much more complex, are really sort of left out in the cold when it comes to the actual conversations that people are having in the political sphere. And so part of what I think Sullivan is right about is that the interpretation that people have of what modern feminism stands for does, in fact, sort of trigger this kind of alt-right reaction to that, where you get people who say, oh, well, you know, feminism is anti-male. Now, all of a sudden, I need to reassert my masculinity. I need to sort of bring out the, you know, importance of aggression and competition and all of these sorts of things. When in reality, feminism hasn't made that argument in many, many years. And it was a very small, small subset of feminists who actually made that argument to begin with. So I think that's part of my I think Sullivan is absolutely right when he points to how feminism is understood in the broader political context, where I think he sort of goes where I think his argument is too simplistic is when he's talking about sort of he had this experience of being a man, right, because he took testosterone. I mean, this goes back to one of the things that I think feminists have been trying to tease out for many, many years, starting with people like Simone de Beauvoir in her book, The Second Sex, which is, you know, how do I define what it means to be a woman? We don't actually have a really good definition for what it means to be male or female, even. So people who try to reduce it to chromosomes, they very quickly come up against intersex individuals, for example, people who have androgen insensitivity syndrome. So you can have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. So you can be genetically male. But if your body does not absorb the androgens that it's producing, you will appear, by all accounts, female. You will grow up a female. You will not even know that you have testes until you have to get them surgically removed if they start causing pain. So you have no idea that you are, quote unquote, genetically male, because by all sort of social and cultural and mental and every other sort of characteristic, you are a female. So if it's not chromosomes, then, well, maybe it's hormones. Well, we actually see that that doesn't work really either because of all these other kinds of cases. And so, well, is it body type? Well, no, because the sexes actually overlap considerably when you look at sort of muscle tone and strength, and those, you know, there's differences in the averages. But so the problem that we have is that when we look at sort of how we define what it means to be male or what it means to be female, it's a holistic definition that takes into account a wide variety of considerations, some of which are socially mediated. Some of them are social constructs. And so I think Sullivan's sort of part of the frustration of an academic looking at this piece is a lot of what he's saying is sort of commonsensical, but it's also very simplistic in the assumption that he now knows what it's like to be a man because he took testosterone. Well, he's been a man his whole life, and he knows that he's been a man his whole life. And so we have to think about sort of what other characteristics does he have as a man that helped him identify in that kind of way. And it wasn't just testosterone, obviously, because he was still a man, or at least he still identified as a man, before he took the testosterone.
Well, and on that subject of quote-unquote what it means to be a man, Andrew Sullivan saying that testosterone makes men more aggressive, makes men more animalistic, and that, as I read earlier, he said that men need to be controlled, and he's sort of acknowledging that. I wonder, Lauren, how you feel about his comments regarding just the way the sort of animals that are not human beings function. He writes the following: feminists are not currently campaigning to shut down the Planet Earth television series because it reveals that in almost every species, males and females behave differently, very differently, and there appears to be no patriarchy in place to bring this about at all. Feminists know enough not to push their arguments into those places where it will seem to be, quite obviously, ridiculous. So do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, again, I think it's a really simplistic argument. So
Overly simplistic.
So males and females, they behave very, very differently in certain species. In other species, they behave very, very similarly. There's a wonderful book by the primatologist Sarah Blaffer Hardy. Her last name is spelled H-R-D-Y, called The Woman That Never Evolved. I strongly recommend it. It's fantastic. I use it in my Women in Politics class. And in that book, she lays out some of the primary differences between the different species of great apes. And so the kinds of great apes that we tend to sort of associate with are those like chimpanzees that tend to, where the males do tend to have high levels of aggression. Same thing with gorillas. So the males are very aggressive. The females are usually much smaller than the males. They tend to be more, it's not that they're less competitive. And this is actually I'm going to come back to this. This is probably my biggest critique of the Sullivan piece, is that I think he's mistaking aggression for competition. And so I would say that testosterone increases competition, but not necessarily aggression. And whether that competition turns aggressive is absolutely a function of our social situations. So I'll give just one example of where I think his looking at the primate literature. So in polygamous species, by polygamous, we mean, of course, males that have that mate with more than one female at a time. Competition between males is very great because there aren't enough females to go around. And in those species, you have high levels of competition and high levels of aggression among males. In the primate species and the great ape species, where you have monogamy, in particular gibbons, you can actually go to the Seneca Park Zoo and they have a gibbon pair. The males and females are identical. The only difference between them is actually their color, which seems to be just an accident of evolution. One is white and one is brown. gibbons are monogamous. They show, the males show very low levels of aggression, very low levels of competition. They help care for the young. They engage in sort of these wild pair bonding rituals to sort of show how bonded they are to each other. It's a fascinating example. So I think Sullivan's point is he, again, and this is, I think, again, where Barbara is making a really important point, is that when he's arguing that men and women are different and look at the rest of nature, he's also cherry picking nature. And so we need to decide we need to start with some definitional issues that he does not bother to do.
All right. So listeners, I want to turn and I'm going to ask Dr. Lisa Voy in a moment what her students say if they self-identify as feminist, because, you know, Lauren says almost none of her mm-hmm. students, boys or girls, men or women, right? I mean, I say boys and girls, they're men and women mm-hmm. in your yep. class. Almost none identify as feminist, self-identify. And you think yep. that does speak to what we would call the marketing problem or the branding problem of modern feminism. Listeners, I want to ask you directly, do you identify as a feminist? And what is your conception of modern feminism? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Lisa Voy, who is the director of the Women and Gender Studies program at the College at Brockport, do you ask that question of your students?
I do ask that question of my students. In the fall, I teach a largely general education population of students that are coming from multiple majors and disciplines. And similar to Lauren, students are very, very reluctant to own that feminist label. In the spring, right now I'm teaching feminist theory, and I'm also teaching a senior seminar in women and gender studies. And these are largely women and gender studies majors and minors who have come into the discipline and are much more informed, and they are much more often to say, absolutely, I'm a feminist. But I sort of agree with the image of what it means to be a feminist is kind of caught in this second wave or even first wave space that was largely fractured among being largely white and privileged. And, you know, it has had like a lot of issues in defining itself. So it's not only the marketing problem, it's how feminism has kind of been, you know, rolled out, so to speak, across its multiple waves. And if we think about right now, I'd argue we're probably in the third wave. And the second wave is really when, you know, I think some of this fracturing took place, and we started to see, you know, some of the own like infighting in the branches of feminism. But I also want to comment on something that Lauren made, which is so important, which is how do we define male and female? Because I think those concepts become very abstract. And Judith Butler would argue that all of this is fiction, that every day it's a fiction that gets inscribed and reinscribed and reinscribed, and that we perform it.
So, what's an example?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, I'd use myself as an example. Like, I get up in the morning, I'm a cis-identified female, I know that, I'm going to put on, you know, what that looks like. And it's so repetitive and so stylized by what that is supposed to look like that I'm doing it automatically. And then the ways that we understand that operating is that that's what we expect of you. We look at you, Evan, and we see you and expect you to perform it in a certain way based on, you know, what's in front of me in terms of your body. And similarly, I'm going to look at Lauren and make an assumption about what I see as her identity. And then that's the expectation of ways that Lauren should perform and ways you, Evan, should perform. And so that kind of stylized repetition says that society expects behaviors that are going to coincide with what we think those behaviors would be. Butler would argue that we've fictionalized that in ways that aren't really true. It doesn't have essence. It's sort of like my arm, right? My arm right here, you can see it, I can touch it. It has corporality to it. But the moment we say, what is feminine, what is femininity, and what is masculinity, that does not have essence until we put it on a body. And then once we put it on a body, then it's performed. But if we just said touch masculinity or touch femininity, we can't touch it. It has no corporality. So that notion of putting that on and doing it and performing it is something that becomes our gender. And that gender gets linked to something that is our sex. And these things get conflated so that we don't really allow for variation and difference among bodies. Sort of might be a tangent going off in a different direction, but I do think it circles back to, you know, Lauren's point on how obscure and abstract this is and how we, you know, have difficulty defining it. And then I think it circles back to Andrew Sullivan's kind of simplistic argument that he's sort of baking this into it in ways that it's not baked in at all.
Okay. Lauren, agree or disagree there?
Yeah, I think I agree with almost everything. I mean, I do think that you know, part of my frustration when people sort of bring up the sort of nature versus nurture argument is that the two are so fundamentally bound up with each other that it's very, very difficult to unravel them. I have three daughters, and my two oldest daughter, the youngest is a baby, so we'll see what she turns into. But the two oldest, you know, my husband is a ski coach. He stays home with the kids. They're very active. I mean, he spends a lot of time introducing them to sports and climbing. And so we kind of joked that we've tried to sort of raise them gender neutral. They didn't have access to princess things. And now for the oldest two, I mean, it's just ballerina stuff all the time. I mean, it's like we couldn't tear them out of their ballerina costumes if we tried. And that's not something that I wanted necessarily, you know, this sort of hyper-feminine. But what we see, interestingly, from a childhood development standpoint, is that right around the time of about sort of 4 and 5, children start paying very, very close attention to the messages that they're getting from the culture about what it means to be
absolutely
sort of man and a woman. And so they absorb that, and they become a sort of hyper version of whatever that is. So little boys become very aggressive or very masculine. Little girls become very feminine. And this is also around the same time that you start seeing many individuals who will become transgender individuals or who already have a sort of gender dysphoria going on. That's around the same time that that becomes sort of apparent, too, is around age 5, because it's sort of where you start thinking to yourself, you know, my brain is telling me that I'm female. What does society expect out of females? So it's absolutely, I think, true that we start getting that performative sort of aspect very, very early on. But the way that I try to explain it to my students is, it's not that biology then plays no role. And I don't think that this is what Barbara was saying. I think biology gives us sort of nudges in particular directions, and then society amplifies those differences. And so you can think of society as sort of a loudspeaker. The initial biological nudges are actually fairly small if you look at the actual differences between men and women. If you look at most of the traits that we talk about, they operate on a normal curve, and most people are somewhere in the middle on all of those traits. Now, what happens is that those traits, those biological sort of differences that are differences on average, get amplified over time by the social messaging that people are receiving. And this can lead to, in a variety of directions, that I think can be really damaging. And so, again, when Sullivan's talking about the importance of sort of reining men in, what I would like him to be more aware of are the ways in which certain kinds of social constructs and certain kinds of environments contribute to and lead to making certain kinds of traits problematic. So, and again, this is my biggest concern with his piece, is that he talks about maleness as being fundamentally aggressive. And that is not true. There is something about maleness that certainly contributes to competition, right, to competitiveness. But whether that competitiveness comes out in a pro-social way.
But you can be competitive without being aggressive?
Absolutely. So if you look at, for example, very successful lawyers, very successful sports people, right? And women also have these traits, obviously, which is why women can be lawyers and participate in sports as well. But you can be a competitive academic, right? In which case there's very little aggression, although I'm sure we've seen some of that in. But I think when we're talking about aggression and we mean physical aggression, I don't think we have to go in that direction.
Okay, no, that's fair, because I'm now thinking of my son, who's about to turn 6, and he loves soccer. He loves when it's an actual competition because he wants there to be winners and losers. And he wants to win more, and to the point where I've actually had conversations like, let's tone this down a little. Mm-hmm. But he is so gentle with other kids. If there's a kid on the field that's down, he is not anywhere near kicking a ball near their physical body. He's helping them up. He's not aggressive physically. He's very competitive about wanting to win.
Yes.
That's interesting. And I hadn't thought about it until just now. So I guess there can be a difference.
Yeah, and I think if you look at, and this I think became particularly obvious after, for example, the crash of 2008, where you look at sort of why, for example, certain kinds of social structures became sort of hyper-competitive and then turned into illegal activity and a variety of other things, that's because the incentives were pointing in the wrong direction. So if we incentivize male aggression, if we tell men that that competitive behavior needs to become aggressive in order for you to win, then you're going to get really damaging kinds of situations. If you tell men that there are healthy outlets for competition, and these are what they look like, aggression doesn't have to be part of that, you can get very, very pro-social kinds of competition.
All right, so listeners, if you're on the phone, Jim, Kate, Caroline, I'm coming to you in just a second. We've got to get our only break of the hour. When we come back, your phone calls, whether you identify as a feminist, what you think about that question. And also, I want to kind of circle back to one of the things James Damore at Google was saying was, well, we should just not really care if companies in tech don't have equal numbers of men and women because there are XYZ natural differences, and therefore that explains that. And this notion of trying to push some sort of equality is artificial and misguided. You can easily extrapolate that. Look at Congress. Look at halls of power in this country. How many governors out of 50 states are women? How many members of the U.S. Senate are women? And are we embedding that expectation that, well, women just don't really do that? And no, I know that we're not saying that, but is that expectation sort of sent, or is that artificial? So we'll talk about that as well as your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, CNN sent one of their reporters to Florida to meet a woman named Florin Goldfarb. She's a big Trump supporter. During the political campaign, she organized local rallies. She had some help from a group called Being Patriotic. Well, turns out that was a front for Russians who were actually organizing. The CNN reporter's actions have been criticized by many as harassing and unfair. So let's talk about how we form beliefs and interact next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jim in Irondequoit first up. Go ahead, Jim.
Howdy.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Hello. I'm calling to ask any of your guests, or you for that matter, if you've seen the movie The Red Pill.
I have not. I don't think any of our guests have either. Sorry about that.
Okay, I highly recommend it. It was made by a feminist, and I think it's quite eye-opening to the entire feminist movement in general.
Okay, thanks. Red pill is a term that we often hear on the alt-right, that they use the term red-pilling to get hip to all of the ways that men and white people are oppressed. I don't know if that's the case here. But I appreciate it, Jim, and I will at least Google the red pill, and we'll see. Next on the phone is Kate in Rochester. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, I'm calling just to say that, one, I've considered myself a feminist my entire life. I was raised with feminist principles, understanding that it's just about seeing, you know, women being able to access all of the same avenues in society and culture and jobs as are afforded to men. I'm also POC, so I'm kind of disturbed by any sort of notion of biological determinism, given the history of how that's been used. But I also, you know, circling back to Andrew Sullivan's article, one of the things that came to mind for me is how often in recent Summer Olympics there has been an athlete who grew up female, understood themselves as biologically female, and then there's this controversy, you know, over their gender simply because they either have a chromosomal abnormality or an androgen disorder or just naturally high levels of testosterone. And all of a sudden, it's seen as that they're cheating, which is absolutely ridiculous. And it seems that Sullivan is trying to equate his own experiences with taking testosterone as male without seeing that there can be, you know, natural differences in levels of testosterone across all human beings, you know, regardless of gender binary. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Lisa Voy, what do you think?
Yeah, I do think, you know, it's an important to really look at this variation across difference. So I think that the moment we start looking at do you have more testosterone than the person next to you, and how do you categorize yourself accordingly, becomes a little bit of a muddy, kind of tricky place to be. So I think that sort of gets to, you know, how we can get caught, I think, or tripped up in this bio code in a way that is not actually accurate or true. And then we can similarly get caught up in trying to categorize people correctly or incorrectly based on what that particular bio code could be. And I think Sullivan's argument, you know, as Lauren said, and the caller's probably alluding to, you know, has some danger in that because it can potentially push somebody in a space that they shouldn't be. And then it also somewhat simplifies this in a way that's X or Y and it's not X or Y.
Okay. Lauren?
I think a couple of interesting things that came out of that caller's comments. The first thing I wanted to mention, and this sort of dovetails off of Barbara's point, is I do think that one of the problems that Sullivan sort of doesn't sort of adequately understand either, is the way in which our social environment influences our hormone levels. So again, it's not the idea that there's a sort of biological determinism where testosterone causes X. Well, the social environment actually influences testosterone levels. So fathers of young children, for example, have much lower testosterone levels than men without access to, who don't spend a lot of time with young children. That's an obvious protective mechanism because you don't necessarily want hyper levels of competition that could bring into aggression. And there's a cortisol link as well there. Studies have shown that after men lose an election, their testosterone levels go down. Studies done of people watching sports show that when your sports team loses, your testosterone levels go down. And that's associated with sort of this depressive feeling as well. So again, when we're talking, you know, the way in which we structure the environment actually affects our hormone levels in a variety of ways as well. And so thinking about it as though biology drives the bus is really mistaking how biology and culture and society interact with one another. And so I think that that's just an important thing to recognize. In terms of the sports case, I think that's bringing up some fascinating issues that I don't know if we're necessarily qualified to even start addressing. She's referring to a couple Olympic athletes. There was an Indian athlete whose name I'm blanking on, who was, she was kicked out of the Olympics a few years back. She's a sprinter, I believe. And it turns out we don't know exactly in her case what the it's believed that she's maybe intersex, but and possibly has a chromosomal abnormality or possibly androgen resistance. But so she had abnormally high levels of testosterone. And so the caller's point, I think, is that we don't want to discriminate against people who have these sort of natural fluctuations. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that that gives you a competitive advantage. At least in many cases, it gives you a competitive advantage. So should women with average testosterone levels be competing against women with abnormally high testosterone levels? And sometimes if you have abnormally high testosterone levels, your body isn't actually absorbing them, so it doesn't give you a competitive advantage. So it's really, really complicated. And I think that it's, you know, I think sports is sort of on the leading edge because we see that's one of the areas in which hormones are so obviously relevant. And so I think there's going to be even more kind of conversations that come out of what the Olympic Committee in general decides to do about, for example, intersex athletes, transgender athletes, and looking at sort of how we think about hormones and the linkage to the way that we assign gender, particularly in terms of sporting competitions. Mm-hmm. That's just an uncharted territory right now.
Yeah, I would agree with Lauren. And I think one of the interesting things that I was thinking about as you were talking is this, using the term, if we think about intersex and using the term chromosomal abnormality, in some ways it's a discourse shift or language shift about ways we understand different chromosome combinations or makeups versus thinking about something that's an abnormality. And then at the same time, if we start thinking about athletics and sports, I think we'd find lots of variation among categories of men sports in terms of what their testosterone levels are, in the same way that we might find lots of variations among women or female-identified athletes in sports. And I think that individual variation is something that's operating here that, you know, is something we really can't begin to start measuring unless we're going to ask our athletes to go in, you know, have these things tested for similarities or differences.
All right, Caroline in Ithaca next on the phone. Go ahead, Caroline.
Hi, yes, thank you so much for having me on. So I've been a feminist my whole life. As soon as I knew what the term was and what it meant, I identified as a feminist. I think even as a child, before I had that term to coin what I was feeling, I definitely believed that women were equal and we're always like finding little things that were different between boys and girls, and or like things that were unequal and kind of picking that and saying quite right. So, yes, I've always been a feminist, and just when thinking about the question that was posed of, you know, why are so many people not identifying as a feminist? And I think a lot of that is because the definition of a feminist is kind of obscure to a lot of people. I don't think a lot of people know that to be a feminist, you just have to believe in the equality of the sexes on social, political, economic grounds. I think a lot of people think that it comes with kind of a grocery list of other beliefs that they have to have in order to be a feminist. And so I, for one, am a pro-life feminist, and I work for an organization called Feminist Choosing Life of New York. So we're a pro-life, pro-women organization that's part of the Consistent Life Network. And we oppose all forms of publicly sanctioned violence, including abortion, capital punishment, war, euthanasia, racism, and poverty. And so we don't believe that abortion is something that empowers women. We think that it's a symptom that our society is failing women. And I think that abortion kind of acts as a Band-Aid to cover up the root social problems that are plaguing women and are leading to some of the disparities that have been discussed today on the show. And so I think that the things that will empower women are equal pay for equal work, affordable child care, and non-discrimination laws to protect pregnant women who are at school or in the workforce from being kicked out or fired. And so I think sometimes in the feminist movement, there has been a division over the issue of abortion. There has been examples of different pro-life feminist groups that have been excluded from women's marches and things like that. And pro-life feminists are deemed as being oxymorons and all sorts of accusations like that. And I think for the feminist movement to really progress and for more people to identify as feminists, they need to know that we're an inclusive movement and there can be a diversity of perspectives within the feminist movement as long as everybody believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes.
All right, so Caroline, thank you very much. Now, on that subject of equality, I mean, I think her definition, broadly speaking, just someone who believes in actual equality to become a feminist. What I hear from some pro-choice feminists, I hear some pro-choice feminists, and Caroline is citing them, who say, you can't be pro-life and be a feminist. Again, I hear that from a lot of people. Caroline hears that. She finds that to be splitting a movement that should be more unified. Can you be pro-life and be a feminist? Dr. Lisa Boy.
So it's super complicated. As the caller was speaking, I was thinking one of the issues that I was feeling is that feminism is being asked to be too much. It's overburdened. It's just challenged in ways that it can't be everything, right? And so that's a really good example of, can it be this and can it be that? And can it be, you know, something else? I think what the caller's point is that if we really are pushing at equality for the sexes and equality, economic, social, and political equality across individuals, we must have a space that disrupts the ways that inequality operates. And one of the ways that inequality operates is that it hits gender and it hits sex. So is there a space for someone to be a pro-life feminist? Absolutely. At the same time, I would argue that if we really look at the tenet, the ultimate pivot point of what feminism means, it means free will, you know, being to exercise your free will in ways that does not have interference or obstruction. And in some ways, you know, as we look at reproductive justice and reproductive justice battles, there is that notion of having free will and control over your own body. At the same time, you know, being respectful and supportive of someone who feels that, you know, terminating a pregnancy is wrong. There is a space for that in the feminist movement. As much as there's a space for someone who says, I want to control my own body and don't want anyone to interfere with how I make that decision.
Caroline, I'm glad you called, and I respect, certainly we respect all different viewpoints.
Absolutely.
I would also say that there's something a little misleading about saying it might be splitting a feminist movement, because if you just polled American women would not want to give up reproductive rights, generally speaking. Now, there is a spectrum on where people think certain procedures should be allowed at what times, and that's probably a whole other conversation. But American women are not clamoring to give up reproductive rights.
Yeah, I think it's a whole other show, because in some ways you could say that, you know, we totally respect someone who thinks abortion is wrong, and that could be me. And at the same time, I could look at Lauren and say, but if you choose to exercise that right, I'm not going to judge you.
Okay. Lauren, you want some quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, I actually think that this went in a wonderful direction, which is that I think Caroline's definition, and this is a really common definition of feminism that I sort of push back against gently with my students, which is this question of sort of that feminism is pushing for equality between the sexes. And I actually don't think that that's what feminism is or can be about. I think that it's looking for freedom, and that it's that concept of free will and the ability to control your choices and the kinds of choices that you make about your life. And it may end up being that by providing women with the free ability to make choices about their lives, that they end up in different places on average than men do. We look at, for example, some of the research on the wage gap. So partially because Caroline brought this up, the equal pay for equal work. A lot of the recent research from economists on the wage gap say that, well, part of that wage gap, or at least a large part of it, is actually the different choices that men and women make about reproduction and how to make decisions about the division of labor once men and women have reproduced. So women tend to take part-time jobs. They tend to take more contingent jobs. They tend to take more flexible jobs in order to stay home with children, or at least to make some kinds of sort of sacrifices for childcare. Now, whether that decision is socially mediated or comes out of the social pressures that we put on women, or whether it is a result of a biological drive to mother, I think it's actually probably a combination of the two. But we're probably not going to get to equality if by equality we mean that men and women need to occupy identical social, economic, and political spheres. I just don't think that that's what we're going for. But when it comes to providing women the freedom to make choices over their bodies and over their lives, then that, I think, is a feminism that more people can get behind.
I've got to get through a few emails. We've got a ton of them. Mark wants to know, do your guests believe that there is oppression of women in America today? Is there still a patriarchy? Lauren.
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think that, you know, I suffer very little from the patriarchy as an upper middle class white woman who lives in Pittsburgh. I have an enormous amount of control over my life. I suffer very little sexual harassment, sexual assault. That's going to be much, much different for women who work in different fields, who struggle with poverty, women who struggle with addiction, people of color. There's just a variety of ways in which sex interacts with, or gender interacts with, various other kinds of vulnerabilities. So, the term patriarchy, I strongly dislike, because it sort of assumes that there's this thing out there, you know, like the Matrix or something, that's controlling people's behavior. What I strongly believe is that women's choices are limited in artificial ways currently, in the same, you know, many of the same ways that they've been artificially limited for a very long time. And understanding how women's choices are artificially limited by various kinds of social and economic structures is important.
Okay.
So I totally respect Lauren's point of view, but I slightly differ. And I do think that patriarchy is pervasive and operating in ways that we're not even conscious of. I think it's in systems. It's the landscape under which we live and work. And I think it has power and dominance at its very center. And this is not about the man, or not about patriarchy being the man. It's about a system that has really privileged male power. So we see this operating in politics, in the business world, in professions, in sport. And so there are a lot of different segments of society in which it has its hand. I see this operating because systems have really privileged white males in ways that they have a larger share of capital. They have a larger share of capital, which gives them a larger hand. In terms of ways it impacts me, I would say that it doesn't impact me directly, but it impacts me every single moment that I'm living and breathing, because I'm walking around in a system that isn't equal. And the moment that it's not equal for me, it's not equal for my kids, and it's not equal for, you know, those that we're interacting with. And that, to me, is the point where we really need to reconcile that. I think patriarchy is alive and well.
All right. So against my better judgment, we've got 2.5 minutes, and I'm going to try to wade through a complex subject, so maybe a minute each from each guest. It's terrible hosting. But here is Rachel writing to us saying, hi, feminism means different things to different people. As a radical feminist, I think it is good to honor how women can be different from men. Personally, I don't really care to see women being CEOs and in politics and doing exactly the same messed up things white men have always done. I think if you look at all of history, in some way, women are superior. That led me to think of all the things, I lose it now. Here, there is a, oh my gosh, sorry. I want to turn to Alice Egley, who's a professor of social psychology at Northwestern. When she was talking about James Damore at Google, she wrote, quote, I agree that biological differences likely are part of the reason we see fewer women than men in the ranks of Silicon Valley tech workers. Egley explained that men tend to score higher on spatial reasoning tests, and this may give them an edge in computer science. She concludes that women tend to be more interested in people, men more interested in things, but there are still social aspects that interweave there. So, final thoughts here, Barb. Should we expect men and women to gravitate towards tech or politics or different jobs more often men more than women more than men in different fields? Or is that mostly a social construct?
I really think that's a social construct in terms of opportunities that we've been introduced, things that we hone and practice and get good at. So you could argue that men have, you know, kind of honed the tech field, women the caring, nurturing field, only because those are environments under which we've been allowed to have access to.
And construction really, work. Do you think naturally, is there any difference?
I think that we could see women be great construction workers if we started right now and we introduced construction work as an option for women, and a lot of women started doing that, we'd see women building stronger muscles and doing that construction work, or maybe even making really hard decisions about where to place that, you know, large piece. So I do think, like, this is something that, you know, I would argue. And I guess the second thing I want to say is, problematically, this is the feminist problem. I think starting off with a liberal, reform-based approach to equality was about trying to reconcile and create equality based on male design. It was trying to ask women to be men in order to be equal. And I think radicals are really disrupting and pulling that up by the root and saying there's another way that we can achieve equality.
30 seconds. Differences in jobs fields. Are there natural differences, or mostly is that social, Lauren?
I think there's absolutely natural differences between what men and women on average are going to be sort of attracted to and good at, and that society then amplifies those differences.
So the message from Lauren seems to be there are differences. They tend to be more nudges than big differences, and society has served to amplify and sometimes caricature those differences.
Yeah.
And it's our job to kind of understand where do we think they are on the spectrum and understand how that's impacting us. And it's complex. Some of our listeners said, you know, this whole thing on feminism can't be distilled into a sentence. That's right. That's why we're here. We're going to be here again. We're going to do this again. And I want to thank our guests for coming in and taking the time. Lauren Hill is an associate professor of political science at RIT. Great having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Barbara Lee Savoy, director of the Women and Gender Studies program at the College of Brockport. As always, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Evan. Thanks.
All right. Short break. More connections coming up.